all want to know, what was the primary outcome?
Are we leaving some of our patients paralyzed without actually adequate sedation?
Does an intervention create an incremental gain in what it's designed to change?
Is there a winner here in terms of inotropic agents?
Really, what you're trying to look for is favorable neurologic survival at discharge.
What do we do with vasopressin and methylprednisolone? Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, coming to you from Baltimore. And as always, I am joined here on CCPEM by my other three co-hosts and amazing friends, amazing stars, amazing clinicians, Dr. Peter W., Dr. John Greenwood, and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. Gentlemen, we are getting things started. Well, we've had one podcast for January 2022 already, but this is our annual fun review. A look back over the preceding year worth of articles and just some impactful, important articles to know from the 2021 Emergency Medicine, Critical Care, and Resus literature. But before doing our cruise through the literature, let me check in, see how you're doing. Peter, how are you doing this podcast?
So doing fine. It looks like in New Orleans, we have peaked out with Omicron and are on the backside. A lot of our nursing staff are back at work. So that makes our jobs much easier. So just a shout out to all those folks impacted by yet another uptick in COVID and the need and appreciation for our multidisciplinary teams.
Well said. And it does look like many of us, depending on the region, have summited the Omicron peak mountain and are on the downside, still very much active in terms of lots of infections and high testing percentage, but better than a week or so ago. So well said there. John, how are you?
Doing great, Mike. In the Northeast, we're getting a little chilly. We're going to be talking about a lot of cardiac arrest trials, therapeutic hypothermia, target temperature management being one of the topics, I believe. We got our own little trial going on, the just go outside trial, because the temperature is in the low single digits each morning. We can save a lot of money by just putting patients outside and cooling them.
That is exactly right. It's that time of year that we've all refreshed ourselves, I think, at least where you and I practice in the Northeast, on our hypothermia protocols. And then we've also connected with our ECMO people about ECPR for some of these cases. I don't know, John, if you've had a few come in, hypothermic arrests and placed on ECMO.
Yeah, we had a great save just a week ago. Initial core temperature of 24 degrees was brought in. Started out with a Brady PA arrest to VFib to ECPR, cooled up, narrow intact survival. Awesome. It was an exciting day for the emergency department and the cardiac arrest teams.
Great job. Great job. Well, Rob, how are things out on the West Coast?
We're doing very well. We likewise have plateaued in terms of Omicron. Our ICU is pretty busy, actually, but we are seeing a dip in the number of cases just this week. And this is probably my favorite CCPM discussion. I love the lit review and excited to go through these articles.
Well, without further ado, that's a great segue. Let us get started in cruising the 2021 critical care, resus, and EM literature. And let's tackle some articles in cardiac arrest. Perhaps it is the quintessential resuscitation and critical care state. We see it often out of hospital, in hospital cardiac arrest. And for those of you that are a little bit longer term listeners to CCPEM, you know that we've reviewed that 2020 AHA update that got published about October of 2020. And it's their five-year update with respect to any new recommendations and in that latest AHA guidelines. In terms of medications, they continue to give epinephrine a class one recommendation, a strong recommendation, give 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. And for those that present with a non-shockable rhythm, they're citing recent evidence from a systematic review that says, well, if you can get epinephrine earlier in non-shockable rhythm, perhaps you have increased ROSC rates. And for those with shockable rhythm, still concentrate on early defibrillation, but then epi administration afterwards. And we do have the Paramedic 2 trial. Now, the Paramedic 2 trial, recall, we reviewed a few years ago here on the podcast, and this was the very large randomized controlled trial done in the UK, where they randomized out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients to receive either epinephrine or saline or placebo. And in their primary outcome of 30-day survival, what they determined was, well, there was increased ROS rates and maybe some increased survival, but not necessarily with meaningful and favorable neurologic recovery. So, John, do we have any updated literature that would suggest, you know, what's going on beyond 30 days? Did anyone take a look at longer-term survival?
Yeah, so the long-term outcomes study results came out, was published in Resuscitation 2021 this past year. And basically, the authors looked at six-month survival with favorable neurologic outcome, as well as up to 12-month survival between the two groups, whether they received epinephrine or placebo. And to be honest, not to bury the lead, but there was just no difference between the groups. Now, looking specifically at the six-month survival with favorable neurologic outcome, those with severe neurologic impairment were more common in those who got epinephrine. So perhaps a reflection of the increased ROS rates, perhaps a few of the really sick patients survived, but were severely neurologically impaired, but really overall, no difference between either group. So the take-home point here is that epinephrine may have improved both 6 and 12 month survival, but really did not demonstrate any improvement in favorable neurologic outcome between the groups. So it'll be interesting to see in the next iteration of the AHA guidelines what the evidence base is for the use of epinephrine in cardiac arrest.
Great start, John. And what I failed to mention is that we will have a handout associated with this podcast that links and has all of the articles listed as well as these take-home points. But starting off with cardiac arrest, we are used to giving epi, but now we've got literature to support that even longer-term outcomes, while it may uptick slightly in the number of patients that are alive, does not change outcomes with respect to favorable neurologic survival. Well, Peter, let me ask you, we've got other medications in our armamentarium potentially for cardiac arrest. And, you know, I have to say that when we do cardiac arrests, even out of hospital cardiac arrests, one of those medications that is frequently, not all the time, but frequently given is calcium. And, you know, that could be in the setting of perhaps suspected hyperkalemia, could be calcium channel blocker overdose. But if you just look across the broad spectrum, now I'm going to drill down for a moment here on in-hospital cardiac arrests. The literature would suggest that probably about a third of time in in-hospital cardiac arrests, we're routinely given calcium. Do we have anything that would inform us, you know, does calcium help? Is it an important medication to give in all comers or patients who present with undifferentiated out-of-hospital cardiac arrest?
You know, that's a legit question. And JAMA article this year, published online in November, looked at the effect of intravenous or intraosseous calcium versus saline on the return of spontaneous circulation in adults without hospital cardiac arrest. And so great study design, randomized placebo-controlled parallel group, double-blind superiority trial out of Denmark in adults who received at least one dose of epinephrine, and they were randomized 1-to-1. So not to be the party pooper, but for the calcium lovers, no evidence that supported this. They actually stopped the trial early at 383 patients enrolled after being planned for over 600 patients. A well-balanced study, but the primary outcome, sustained ROSC, favored the placebo group, not statistically different. Secondary outcome, survival at 30 days, shocker here, again, placebo group wins out, not statistically different. And then another secondary outcome, survival at 30 days with a favorable neurological outcome, again, favoring the placebo group, but not statistically different. So really the take-home point for this is the administration of calcium in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest isn't something we should be doing. It did not improve a sustained ROSC in those patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So again, important that they excluded, as Mike mentioned earlier, those patients with calcium channel blocker overdoses and those patients with hyperkalemia. The calcium indicated in those cases, strong evidence, let's continue doing that. But in those cases where we're not suspecting that as a cause for the cardiac arrest, leave the calcium in the box.
Well said. Important article. This was referred to as the COCA trial. And Peter, I think you nailed it with respect to when we have a suspicion of those select conditions, we're not saying don't give it. Those are the patients that weren't included. But if we just strictly look at an undifferentiated patient, we're not suspicious of one of these select conditions. The routine administration of calcium really isn't indicated and isn't improving patient-centered outcomes. So great, great article. All right, Rob, I'm putting you on the spot here. Way back in 2009, maybe way back, but 2009 and in 2013, there were two studies that looked at this combination of vasopressin and methylprednisolone to epinephrine in in-hospital cardiac arrest patients. And in those two studies, I think they were done out of Greece, they showed that, or investigators showed that there was improved ROSC and maybe even improved survival, possibly to hospital discharge, when the combination of vasopressin and methylprednisolone were given to patients. And I'll be honest, over the years, I think all four of us, as we've given talks on cardiac arrest, we've probably been asked the question from an attendee, hey, what do we do with vasopressin and methylprednisolone? And I don't recall that there's ever been a follow-up study, but I guess perhaps until now, can you take us through what that study is?
Yeah, Mike, this is a great study, a follow-up to those original studies about steroids and vasopressin in in-hospital cardiac arrest. And that's probably the very, very key point, is that this is for looking at in-hospital cardiac arrest patients rather than the out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients that we've been talking about previously. And so this study was a randomized placebo-controlled parallel group, double-blind superiority trial at 10 hospitals in Denmark. They included adult patients over the age of 18 with in-hospital cardiac arrest who had received at least one dose of epinephrine during their arrest. And they randomized people into 1-to-1 ratio of the intervention, which was vasopressin at 20 units, an infusion, basically a push of 20 units of vasopressin, and methylprednisolone, 40 milligrams. These were administered as soon as possible after the first dose of epinephrine, and additional doses could be administered after each epinephrine dose to a maximum of 4 doses of this combination. The placebo group was just ampules of saline. And their primary outcome was return of spontaneous circulation for at least 20 minutes. And their secondary outcomes were survival at 30 days and favorable neurologic outcome at 30 days. So they enrolled a total of 501 patients in this analysis, relatively equally distributed in terms of baseline characteristics. And again, with regard to their primary outcome, which was ROSC for at least 20 minutes, they found significant difference in the intervention group of 42% achieved ROSC versus 33% in the placebo group. And that amounts to a risk ratio of 1.3 with a significant confidence interval. In terms of their secondary outcomes, however, their 30-day survival, there were no differences in 30-day survival between the two groups. The placebo group had 12% survival, and the vasopressin methylprednisolone group had 9.7% survival. In terms of favorable neurologic outcome, the vasopressin group, they're again evenly matched, precisely evenly matched, with 7.6% in both groups having favorable neurologic outcome. And then probably the most important outcome is favorable neurologic outcome at 30 days. And again, they found no statistical significant differences between the two groups. And in fact, there's a trend towards worse outcome in the intervention group. The placebo group had 7.2% favorable neurologic outcome at 30 days, and the intervention group had 4.6%. This did not reach statistical significance, but certainly there's a signal there. So the limitations of this study are that they screened a lot of patients, but only included about 500. This was multi-center, but it was only one country in Denmark. And the greatest limitation was really their choice of primary outcome. ROSC at 20 minutes is not a patient-centered or system-centered primary outcome that I would seek. Really, what you're trying to look for is favorable neurological survival at discharge and at 30 days. So their declaration of ROSC for 20 minutes as their primary outcome is really not ideal. Additionally, there were a few differences that occurred in the post-resuscitation period between the two groups, and 90% of patients in this study had initial non-shockable rhythm. So really the take-home points from this are, although vasopressin and methylprednisolone increased ROSC for patients in hospital cardiac arrest, it did not improve survival at 30 days and survival with favorable neurological outcome. So the use of vasopressin and steroids for patients in hospital cardiac arrest is certainly not indicated at this point, probably requires further study.
Great job, Rob. So I think this is a super helpful paper from 2021. We've been wondering for years what really the follow-up has been for this combination. And now we've got it in a randomized control fashion that it really doesn't improve that 30-day survival or survival with favorable neurologic outcomes. So important piece of literature from 2021. All right, well, let's close the book on some cardiac arrest articles and let's shift to post-arrest care. We've done the hard work. We've achieved ROSC. Well, actually, maybe the hard work lies ahead in treating patients in the post-arrest setting. John, I'm going to swing back around to you. A vexing question that we face too often when we get patients with ROSC is, should we send them to the cath lab? And I think we're all on board, class one recommendation, AHA. I don't think there's any debate per se. If in the midst of post-ROSC, you get the EKG, it shows a STEMI, we're contacting our cardiology colleagues for consideration of emergent cath lab or cath lab activation. And 2 years ago, we reviewed the COAC trial that took a look at the non-diagnostic EKG, the NSTEMI patient after ROSC. And at least in shockable rhythm patients, sending them off for immediate cath didn't change the overall outcome for patients compared to those that had delayed transport to the cath lab or delayed activation at some point later during the hospital course. But the knocks on the COAC trial was that it only looked at shockable rhythm. And at the end of the day, somewhere at around 5 to 10% of patients, only that percent had a thrombotic lesion or a lesion amenable to PCI. So help us out. What do we do with the non-shockable patients? And how do we make sense of who should go off to immediate cath or not?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. So I think most of us have heard of this as the Tomahawk trial published in New England Journal. Now, funny thing is they didn't try to use the letters in the title in some odd way to get to Tomahawk. They just named themselves the Tomahawk Investigator Group, and this was the Tomahawk trial. So kudos to them for not trying to do anything weird with the title. But as you said, the primary objective here was really to determine whether or not out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients with ROSC, but without ST elevation, benefited from early or immediate angiography. Now, this was, again, an investigator-initiated, randomized, multi-center, open-label trial conducted in a lot of centers, so over 30 centers in both Germany and Denmark. They included adults that were resuscitated from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And as you said, these were with both shockable and non-shockable rhythms, which was different from COACT, and obviously no ST elevations on the EKG. Now, the intervention was fairly straightforward. It was either immediate or delayed coronary angiography. And then essentially for the delayed group, they were first transferred to the ICU for further care and then could proceed to the cath lab after 24 hours, depending on kind of what was going on. And the cath lab was within 24 hours if there was a significant increase in troponin, electrical instability, cardiogenic shock, or the evolution of an ST elevation MI once in the ICU. So they looked at 30-day all-cause mortality, as well as a number of other secondary outcomes. And what did they find? Well, it was a large trial, so over 500 patients were eligible and then ultimately included in the trial. And they were fairly evenly split, so around 280 subjects in both groups. Now, in terms of the intervention, so in 96% of the immediate angiography arm got emergent coronary angiograms with a quick time to cath lab. And unlike some of the other cardiac arrest trials, CAD was actually more prevalent in these trials. So in the immediate group, it was a little over 60%, and revascularization occurred in 40% of the immediate angiography group. And then in the delayed group, about two-thirds of the patients ended up getting cathed, and a little over 70% of them had CAD. And there was a 40% incidence of likely coronary cause. So those received revascularizations. But we all want to know, what was the primary outcome? So 30-day all-cause mortality, when you looked between the groups, there was a difference. So the immediate angiography group, there was a 54% all-cause mortality compared to the delayed group, which was 46%. So that p-value there was 0.06, so just nearly missed that significant threshold here. But in terms of secondary outcomes, there's really no difference in the majority of them, and they're all really exploratory. So not worth going into here, but certainly worth noting that primary outcome. So what were the limitations of this trial? This was an important one. It was another randomized control trial looking at a really important clinical question. Well, it was open label. So certainly, you know, you can't blind the clinicians to whether or not your patient was going to get cath. They excluded in-hospital cardiac arrests and those with ST elevations, electrical or hemodynamic instability. So this was all only for out-of-hospital arrest. 22 patients that were randomized to the delayed angiography group got a cath in under 24 hours. So this was likely due to an evolution of their symptoms once they got to the ICU, despite no protocol indication, a strict protocol indication per se. So I think the take-home points here are, among out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients with return of spontaneous circulation and no evidence of ST elevated MI on EKG after ROSC, there's no benefit to immediate coronary angiography compared to those with delayed angiography after ICU admission in terms of 30-day mortality.
That was an amazing job, John. In terms of this article, I think it does provide a lot of information. And now that we've got Tomahawk, I like the acronym there, as you said it, that was well done. And now that we have COAC, I think we've got now a good database to say that there's certainly going to be specific patients where we have a high pretest probability, and we're still going to talk to our cardiac cath colleagues, but just considering all comers, not a rush to get patients from the ED to the cath lab in the setting of an NSTEMI or non-diagnostic EKG after ROSC. All right, well, Peter, I'm coming back around to you. Before we leave post-arrest, the last several years have seen some controversial studies, literature, opinions on the implementation of targeted temperature management. Is it useful? What temperature do we take patients to? Is it simply the avoidance of fever that makes the difference in post-arrest patients? And in 2021, we've got TTM2. So take us through TTM2 and give us the take-home message as where we stand, or at least what this article showed in terms of therapeutic hypothermia or targeted temperature management.
You got it, Mike. So we've got a New England Journal article published this year, and their objective was to assess the beneficial and harmful effects of hypothermia as compared with normothermia and early treatment of fever in patients after cardiac arrest. So the study's an international investigator-initiated superiority trial was performed in 61 centers and 14 countries. The patients that were included were adults over the age of 18. They were admitted to the hospital after, important now, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest of a presumed cardiac or unknown cause. Any rhythm gets you in the door, and more than 20 consecutive minutes of ROSC. They had to remain unconscious and unable to follow verbal commands to be enrolled. What was the hypothermia group? Well, they were immediately cooled to 33 degrees using either cold IV fluids, surface devices, or some intravascular device. You get to pick. It was maintained for a total of 28 hours, and they were rewarmed to 37 degrees in hourly increments. Now, we're going to compare that cooled group with the normothermia group, who were maintained temperature of 37.5 or less. If the temperature reached greater than 37.8, cooling with surface or intravascular devices was initiated to a target temperature of 37.5. There was no active warming or cooling initiated for patients who had spontaneous temperatures less than 37.8, right? So we weren't going to warm or cool those people who had spontaneous temperatures less than 37.8. Neuroprognostication performed at 96 hours after randomization or later. So it could have been later. Primary outcome was all-cause mortality at 6 months. The secondary outcome was poor functional outcome at 6 months and the number of days alive and out of the hospital until 180 days. Adverse events, just quick, pneumonia, sepsis, bleeding, and dysrhythmia. So the results, over 1,800 patients included in the intention to treat population. In the hypothermia group, 930 patients. Normothermia group, 931 patients. So the primary outcome, all-cause mortality at 6 months. In the hypothermia group, 50%. Normothermia group, 48%. It was consistent across subgroups, whether it was gender, age, initial rhythm, as well as shock that was present on admission. So equivalent relative risk with hypothermia, 1.04. So the secondary outcome was poor functional outcome at 6 months. Hypothermia group, 55%. Normothermia group, 55%. Relative risk with hypothermia was 1. Adverse events, arrhythmias, hypothermia group, 24%. Normothermia group, 17%. There was no difference in pneumonia, sepsis, or bleeding observed in this group. Just one small limitation, where there was really no control group without targeted temperature management included. Almost 50% in the normothermia group had targeted temperature management applied to keep temperature below the target. So what's really the take-home point here? Targeted temperature management to a temperature of 33 degrees did not lower 6-month all-cause mortality in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest compared to those treated with targeted temperature management to target normothermia. So no difference in the two groups.
Very important finding in terms of the TTM2 trial and all of the downstream podcasts that it generated, the discussions, the blog posts, the articles. So a key important article in 2021. Peter, thanks for taking us through that one. Well, you know, let's move on from cardiac arrest and post-arrest. Let's move over to probably one of the more common critical care procedures we perform, and that's actually intubation and then initiation of mechanical ventilation. And with respect to RSI, Rob, turning back to you here, you know, a few years ago, I believe in a single center trial in Minnesota, a very prolific investigator group reported and published that in their study, the use of the bougie first, so we go to intubate. This isn't bougie as a rescue device, but using bougie first compared with an endotracheal tube with stylet resulted in a much higher first pass success rate in patients that were characterized or having characteristics of a difficult airway. And, you know, coming out of that trial, many of us already liking the bougie really started to use it much more. And I guess the question remained, why not just always use bougie first? Use your video or direct laryngoscopy, and then simply reach for the bougie, and you get a higher first pass success rate and a safer intubation. Well, we talked about the bougie trial just a few months ago in a recent podcast that took a look at this outside of a single center in a randomized, once again, fashion. Can you take us through what the bougie trial tells us regarding RSI and the use of this as it pertains to first pass success?
Yeah, Mike. So this was a great trial by Brian Driver, a colleague who's an outstanding investigator. And their objective was to compare the effect of using a bougie versus an endotracheal tube with a stylet on outcomes of tracheal intubation in EDs and ICUs across multiple health systems. So basically trying to see whether bougie first, the standardized using bougie first, instead of an endotracheal tube with a stylet, improves outcomes. And so this was a randomized, pragmatic, parallel group, unblinded trial, obviously had to be unblinded. It was 15 sites, 7 EDs, and 8 ICUs, notably, in 11 U.S. hospitals. And they included patients who were undergoing tracheal intubation with planned use of sedation and a non-hyperangulated blade. In the intervention group, the bougie group, they had operators were instructed to use a bougie during their first attempt at intubation versus the stylet group. The stylet group used endotracheal tube with a malleable stylet for their first attempt at intubation. So basically comparing what we call the usual standard, which is an ET tube with a stylet versus a bougie for your first attempt at intubation. And their primary outcome was successful intubation on the first attempt. Very simple primary outcome. Their secondary outcomes were the incidence of severe hypoxemia between induction and 2 minutes after intubation, which was defined as an SpO2 less than 80%. So in terms of the results, they randomized 1,102 patients, and they were pretty evenly matched between the two groups. Their baseline characteristics were similar, and the most common reasons for intubation were altered mental status and acute respiratory failure. Notably, the most common operator, the most common intubators in this trial were emergency medicine physicians. And most of the operators were residents. 62% were residents. So this was obviously held in a highly academic environment. And the operators had performed a median of 60 total intubations prior to the trial. So in terms of their primary outcome, the first pass success, bougie group was 80.4% and the stylet group was 83%. There were no significant differences in this primary outcome, nor were there any significant differences when they adjusted analyses for any pre-specified subgroups. In terms of their secondary outcomes, secondary outcome of severe hypoxemia, there was no significant difference. The bougie group had 11%. The stylet group had 8.8%. And airway complications, which they looked at as well, including post-intubation pneumothorax, were evenly matched, about 2.5% between the two groups. Cardiovascular collapse was also similar between the two groups, 12.2% in the bougie versus 16.7% in the stylet group. The limitations are that they excluded patients for whom the urgency of intubation precluded randomization. In other words, your crash sort of intubation group, they excluded that group of patients. They excluded use of hyperangulated laryngoscopes. They excluded patients for whom use of a bougie was indicated by the primary physician, basically patients who they thought that needed a bougie outright. And then other limitations included, it was not blinded, and most of the operators in the trial had limited experience using a bougie. So the take-home point really from this study is that among critically ill adults requiring tracheal intubation in semi-elective situations, use of a bougie did not significantly increase the incidence of successful intubation on the first attempt compared with the ET tube with a stylet.
All right. So perhaps not really, Rob, just completely moving away from the bougie. It certainly has its indications, but I guess every time you go to intubate, the bougie trial would suggest that we don't need to always and in every case use the bougie as the first attempt to increase our chances of success. Would that be about right?
Yeah, exactly. This study in no way is arguing against the use of the bougie when you think you need it, you know, certainly as a rescue device or any other sort of indication for a bougie. This is just saying that in pretty much semi-elective, I mean, not crash intubations, that use of a bougie primarily does not improve your first chance success over what we typically do now, which is an ET tube with a stylet. So no need to change your basic intubation mode, but still, if you need a bougie otherwise, this does not argue against that.
Got it. All right. Well, let's say we have been successful, whether it be first or second pass success. We get the tube in, we've given our RSI medications, we are listening to the lungs, placing the patient on capnography, we are ordering our post-intubation chest x-ray, perhaps placing a line, dropping an OG tube, maybe doing Foley catheters, all those things. We're thinking, most importantly, about what additional care patients need. Well, in some cases, we don't remember the duration of action of our paralytics and sedatives. And the concern is, well, are we leaving some of our patients paralyzed without actually adequate sedation, and they're just very aware of everything that's going on around them and what we are doing to them. And John, I'm going to turn to you. We've got a little bit of anesthesia literature to suggest that, well, this concept of awareness with paralysis, it's not actually that common. It's about 0.1 or 0.2%. But we don't really have any good information. How often is this occurring in the ED? Maybe you can help us out with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, this is a great pick. And you mentioned some really important things here, because oftentimes we get so focused on all of the things that we have to get done to take care of this patient that we forget that, oh my goodness, they could be awake. And you know, that 0.1%, that's pretty uncommon. But this ED awareness study really brought to the forefront some important information that we can take to the bedside for our next critically ill patient. So this study is published in Emergency Medicine Literature, so the Annals of Emergency Medicine. And the authors here's main objective was to estimate the prevalence of awareness during paralysis in patients who just had undergone RSI and are receiving mechanical ventilation. So this was a prospective cohort study at a single academic center, and they included basically adults who underwent mechanical ventilation using a general routine endotracheal tube. And it could have been performed in their emergency department prior to arriving to the emergency department in the pre-hospital setting or from an outside facility. And they really gathered all the clinical data through their EMR, but that really wasn't the important part of the study. What was really important was prior to discharge, they assessed the patients to learn about whether or not there was a chance, whether it was probable or whether they did remember being paralyzed, but were completely awake. And so that was the primary outcome, was awareness with paralysis. And they used a couple questionnaire tools, and they had some secondary outcomes as well that were identified as a mediator causal pathways, and basically PTSD symptoms. And what did they find? Well, they included 383 patients in this study. So it wasn't all that small. And they found that 27 patients reported memories of wakeful paralysis and were evaluated for basically the primary outcome. So what they did was they took these 27 patients and did an adjudication between the group to confirm whether or not there was a likelihood that they were awake and paralyzed. And what they found was that 2.6% of these ED patients, and this was significant based on the confidence interval, likely were awake but paralyzed during their presentation. And when they drilled down on it, they found that exposure to rocuronium at any time in the ED that they received either during RSI or post-intubation was significantly different between patients who experienced awareness and paralysis versus the rest of the cohort. Now, despite that is a small cohort, but it makes sense, right? There's face validity to this, that the long-acting paralytic of rocuronium makes it more likely that your patient is going to be paralyzed but awake. So there are some limitations here. Granted, this isn't a huge trial, but 383 patients is still pretty large in my opinion. It's a single center, so certainly it's a possibility that something at that specific center might have led patients to have more likely awareness, but being paralyzed, maybe it was something in their epic order set or their style, how they performed RSI, as opposed to how we do it or what you'd find in a multi-center trial. This is a subjective assessment, so there's really no way to objectively define wakefulness during paralysis. But, you know, all in all, I think the take-home point here is we need to be more aware, no pun intended, we need to be more aware or cognizant of our sedation practices after RSI. So watch out for that prolonged paralysis and no sedation, particularly if you're using rocuronium. It is a much higher incidence than what we'd like to see, particularly if we're grading ourselves against our anesthesia colleagues. And given the number of patients that we perform intubation on in the US, you know, this is a potentially really high number and something that's easily preventable. So, you know, my general suggestion is after RSI, you know, get your post-intubation sedation and analgesia up and running. If you don't have the ability to get it immediately at the bedside, use some sort of bolus dose of a benzodiazepine or something that can bridge you to your usual fentanyl, propofol, whatever it is you use for analgo sedation after rapid sequence intubation.
Really great job there, John. Now, to our listeners, let's just touch on two more articles here. And Peter, I'm going to go to you for our second to last. And You know, quite honestly, we, at least in the emergency department, I think we're familiar with septic shock. I think it's the most common type of shock that we are used to managing, and less so cardiogenic shock. And so I would say that probably the application or administration of inotropes occurs, but less frequently in the ED compared to, say, vasopressors. And the question becomes, well, dobutamine, I know about milrinone, which inotropic agent really is better for the treatment of patients that were able to make the diagnosis of cardiogenic shock in the ED or even in the ICU? Is there a winner here in terms of inotropic agents?
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a little bit. This is a study published in New England Journal this year that looked at milrinone as compared with dobutamine in the treatment of cardiogenic shock. And, you know, 10, 20 years ago, this was a non-issue because milrinone was expensive care medicine. And so we just reached for dobutamine out of habit, mostly due to cost. And so the objective was to compare the efficacy and safety of milrinone and dobutamine in patients with cardiogenic shock in a pragmatic randomized clinical trial. And so in the study, patients were randomized in a double-blind clinical trial fashion, and they used a single center in studying this at the University of Ottawa. And patients needed to be 18 years of age or older, admitted to an ICU that delivered cardiac care, and had cardiogenic shock as defined by the Society for Cardiovascular Angiography and Interventions, a strict definition. Now, the trial procedures, they were assigned in a one-to-one fashion to receive either milrinone, a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, or dobutamine. And once they were randomized, patients received the medication in a concealed bag. And so the primary outcome was a composite outcome of in-hospital death from any cause, resuscitated cardiac arrest, receipt of a cardiac transplant or mechanical circulatory support, non-fatal MI, a TIA or a CVA, or the initiation of renal replacement therapy. There were some secondary outcomes that were length of stay in the cardiac ICU, dysrhythmia requiring intervention, a total duration of inotropic support, and total hospital length of stay. So well-designed. The results, a total of 192 patients were ultimately enrolled. The primary outcome in the dobutamine group, 54%, in the milrinone group, 49%, with a relative risk of 0.9. No effect on pre-specified subgroups, including affected ventricle or the concomitant use of vasopressors. So for the secondary outcome, no real difference in the individual components of the composite primary outcome, no difference in total duration of inotropic support, no change or difference in hospital length of stay or ICU length of stay, no difference in any dysrhythmias that required intervention, and no difference in heart rate, mean arterial pressure, serum lactate, creatinine, or urinary output. I see the take-home point being that the DOREMI trial didn't really find a significant difference between milrinone and dobutamine for patients with cardiogenic shock. I would just add this, that again, there's no real cost differential between the two, but the half-life of milrinone is substantially greater than dobutamine. That's the only real differential between those two, but that consideration.
Very nice, Pearl, Peter, and very nice job reviewing this particular trial. I think that gives us and informs us a lot in terms of our practice for patient population. Well, we may be missing in making the diagnosis of cardiogenic shock, but when we've made it, we've confirmed it, it helps us in terms of thinking, are we making the right selection? And it seems that there's no clear-cut winner, but an important pearl about duration of action. All right, Rob, you're going to bring us home here, close us out. Our last article that we'll touch on for 2021 literature updates here. And that deals with, well, our favorite topic, I think, and that is fluid resuscitation. We talk a lot about balanced fluids. And in full disclosure, as we record this podcast, within the last 24 to 48 hours, the PLUS trial has been released in New England Journal of Medicine. So it is something that, listeners, we will review as well in the upcoming next few podcasts. So stay in touch for that. But to that end, we've had an important fluid resuscitation trial published in 2021, and that is the BASICS trial. Rob, give us the take-home message and the fundamentals here of the BASICS trial. What do we need to know?
Yeah, Mike, fluids truly are our passion, and I like this study, although I have questions about the limitations that we'll discuss later. But The objective of this study was to assess whether the use of a balanced solution, like PlasmaLyte in this case, during the ICU stay compared with normal saline would improve 90-day mortality in critically ill patients. And this was a randomized clinical trial conducted in 75 ICUs in Brazil. And the inclusions were patients admitted to an ICU requiring at least one fluid expansion at the discretion of the attending physician. They were also not expected to be discharged within the next day, and they had to meet at least one of the following criteria. They had to either older than 65, hypotension defined as a MAP less than 65, or systolic blood pressure less than 90, or the use of pressors, sepsis, requiring non-invasive ventilation for at least 12 hours, early signs of kidney dysfunction, cirrhosis, or acute liver failure. And again, they only had to meet one of those. So it's a pretty broad list that would include a lot of critically ill patients. They randomized patients to receive either normal saline or the balanced solution, in this case, PlasmaLyte. And fluids were supplied in identical 500 ml bags. Physicians, patients, and those who assessed outcomes were blinded to the assigned treatment, and overall patient management otherwise was left to the discretion of the individual attending physicians. Their primary outcome was 90-day survival, and their secondary outcomes were need for renal replacement therapy up to 90 days after enrollment, occurrence of acute kidney injury, SOFA scores assessed at a continuous value, and individual components assessed at days 3 and day 7, and the number of days not requiring mechanical ventilation within 28 days. So they randomized 10,520 patients, a lot of patients. They included that many patients in their analysis, and they were basically very evenly matched in terms of basic characteristics. The intervention groups, both groups received a median of 1.5 liters of fluid during the first day of enrollment. And the accumulated median fluid during the first 3 days was 4.1 liters. In terms of their primary outcome of 90-day mortality, there was no significant difference between the two groups. Mortality in the balanced solution group was 26.4%. Mortality in the saline group was 27.2%. And again, that was not statistically significantly different. In terms of the secondary outcomes, only two were found to be statistically significant. The SOFA score at 7 days was different in the balanced solution group, a median difference of 0.27, mostly due to a higher neurologic SOFA score. And their limitations, again, this was a pretty unselected group of critically ill patients. They had a high number of elective surgical admissions to the ICU. So not a group that you would traditionally, certainly not see from the emergency department. They had an overall lower mortality for patients included in the study than when they originally designed the study. And they also had lower illness severity scores. The other limitation is that they really received relatively modest or small amounts of IV fluids, only 1.2 liters in the first ICU day and 2.9 liters during the first 3 days. So that's not a particularly high volume resuscitation group of study. And another limitation is that almost 70% of patients received IV fluids before enrollment, of which 45% had greater than a liter. So their randomization scheme really is limited in terms of that because they may have had effects from that, the fluids that they had before randomization. And so the take-home points from this study are that among critically ill patients requiring fluid challenges, the use of PlasmaLyte compared with saline did not significantly reduce 90-day mortality or significant other secondary outcomes.
All right. So a very important study. Now, in terms of that PlasmaLyte product they had, I'll be honest, that pH of that product is a little closer to normal saline than it is more familiar PlasmaLyte product that many of us have. But notwithstanding, this is an important finding. And as I alluded to, we will talk about the PLUS study in an upcoming podcast, given that it just got published online. We'll do our due diligence, dive through that, and then do an article discussion. But nonetheless, I think we've covered a lot of very important key articles that got published that actually were non-COVID articles from 2021. So very thankful to be doing a non-COVID talk or discussion. But before we close out here, let me just kind of go around the horn. Peter, I'll start with you, then John, then Rob. For any final thoughts, any additional pearls that we gleaned from 2021 to pass on to folks here tonight?
Yeah, just two things. One is, I think my first go-to for difficult airway is bougie, period. And I think, you know, teaching in the airway course, difficult airway course for over a decade, I think that it's a mistake not to have that at the ready for each and every intubation, because you can't always predict the difficult ones. And so that would be my pearl.
Outstanding. All right, John.
Yeah, no, I really like the awareness study. I think that that was something that, you know, you can really bring to the bedside. Just reviewing, making sure we're familiar with the medications we're using, duration of action. Those types of things are fairly simple changes that make a pretty big difference in our patients' outcomes. So that one is one of my favorite. Just a small, like, kind of point on how to interpret some of these things, the Milrinone trial, always be just a little bit careful with smaller trials that have composite outcomes. Sometimes that can really lead you to think something that there's no difference when maybe there actually is, and we just can't see it yet. I don't think that that's a nail in the coffin. I think it's just requires a little bit more thought and a little bit more study when thinking about inotropes. So just a small, small little pearl there in terms of study and trial interpretation.
Great point. All right, Rob, close us out.
Yeah, I like both of those comments. My comments mainly are directed at the resuscitation studies, the cardiac arrest studies. It's very frustrating, I would say. The arena of meds for cardiac arrest is a very frustrating realm. It seems like there's nothing we can do in terms of meds that can improve outcomes over standard care. And I just kind of don't really know where to go from here in terms of those types of interventions. I still am going to continue giving epinephrine at early and frequent intervals. I am going to pull away from calcium. That study was pretty impressive in that they had to stop it early because it looked like the calcium group was going to do worse. So I'm going to pull away from that. In terms of steroids and vasopressin, again, they really looked at the wrong outcome in terms of ROSC, and the data from, if anything, showed perhaps a little bit worse neurologic survival with methylprednisolone and vasopressin. So I don't know. I'm not going to be incorporating that into my in-hospital cardiac arrest armamentarium either. So I don't know. Overall, just kind of a frustrating in terms of meds for resuscitation. And I hope there's something else out there, but I'm not sure there is.
High quality CPR, early defibrillation, John likes ECMO, and then good post-cardiac arrest care, right? Those are the critical things.
Yeah. And use your ultrasound post-cardiac arrest to kind of tailor your therapy.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, if I could have one wish for the new year, is that we would maybe get away from these heterogeneous large trials and get back to really thinking about personalizing care for our patients, getting some trials that really looked at, does an intervention create an incremental gain in what it's designed to change rather than just 30-day mortality? I think that for critical care to move the needle, we make a lot of small changes that cumulatively add up to make a difference in our patient's outcome. So if I could have one wish for 2021, that would be my wish. Maybe we'll see what comes up in 2022.
All right. Well, with that, let us close the book on our literature review. We know that this annual podcast goes a little bit long because we look back over an entire year worth of literature filled with lots of pearls. And thanks to the three of you really for taking us through these important articles. We are going to close things out. If you have any questions, as always, shoot us an email through the website. Be happy to continue the correspondence. But for now, we will end our annual literature review and look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.